This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Michael Parenti joins Dennis in the Flashpoint studio for a discussion about Obama's plan for expanded war in Afghanistan. Catherine Austin Fitz joins us for another edition of Community Business, looking at the auto bailout, deflation, and what she's calling the financial coup d'etat. And a Palestinian neighborhood in the West Bank city of Hebron is torched and terrorized by violent Jewish settlers on a rampage. We'll hear a report from inside the pogrom. All this with Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman, coming up straight ahead on Flashpoint. Stay tuned.
Again in Brooklyn, Dennis Bernstein. Barack Obama has repeatedly advocated for an expanded war in Afghanistan. His foreign policy team, led by Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates, appears to be gung-ho for the expansion, but well-known author and social critic Michael Parenti thinks it's a very bad idea, and he says that history bears that out. People should take a look at it. Parenti is the author of a new article that appears on Common Dreams and Zenit called Afghanistan, Another Untold Story. His recent books include Contrary Notions and, coming up soon to be released, God and His Demons. Michael, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Nice to be here. Dennis.
Good to have you with us. Well, we heard Obama say this a whole bunch of times, that he wants to bring the war to Afghanistan, even Pakistan, and now he seems to have the foreign policy team that wants to do the same thing.
Yeah, and what I tried to do in the article is remind Americans of the history that was going on here, that in fact we're not there just by accident. We just didn't happen in. What you had back in the late 1970s was a revolution that went on in Afghanistan, and you had a leftish military. By left, I mean reformist military come in, and they started doing all sorts of things like legalize labor unions, put in a minimum wage, progressive income tax, a literacy program, land reform, and also health care, housing, public sanitation. That was under a man named Taraki. Taraki was a poet and a novelist, and he had the backing of this military officer corps that was rather patriotic for Afghanistan and wanted to see some changes and improvements and all that.
And it was a rather enlightened, if not short, adventure. I mean, we saw women thriving in the country, right?
That's right. The king some years before had started some of the reforms for women, but the Taraki government really put it forward, education for women and the like. Well, in a year later, by 1979, the Taraki government was overthrown by a guy named Amin, who many believe was recruited by the CIA during the years he spent in the United States as a student. So in late 1979, he took over. He stopped all the reforms. He murdered and jailed, or he exiled, thousands of Taraki's supporters. And then he, in turn, was he started to sort of establish a fundamentalist Islamic state. And so it's a militant, fundamentalist, reactionary Islamic version of Islam. I mean, not all Islam is that way. That becomes the buttress against any kinds of secular reforms, progressive left reforms. And he, though, was overthrown in a few months by the remnants of the People's Democratic Party, which was this broad coalition of people that had supported Taraki, and also which included elements within the military. So there they were. They were back in. And but things didn't go really very well because, in fact, there were landlords. There was a big landlord class, and there still is in Afghanistan, who did not like the land reforms. There were the herdsmen and peasants who did not like the idea of their women and children going to school. And there was a number of other things like that. And so they started waging a war against the People's Democratic Party government. And that went on into the early 1980s. And that was supported by the CIA and the Pakistani ISI, which is the CIA, is like the Pakistani
CIA. And
this
is a really important point, because when we the common history about Afghanistan is the Russians came in. We supported the Mujahideen to run the Russians out.
Right.
And that's where U.S. involvement started.
Right. American foreign policy and American interventionism is always portrayed in the U.S. press and to the public as being reactive and defensive against some menace that's there, and just compelled to act and commit only because they have to save people's lives, or they got to protect the country, or there's some aggression or something like that. But all of this was happening before the Soviets ever came in. So this war was being waged against the reformist government of Afghanistan, which was really a revolutionary government.
And a very enlightened government that was opening the doors for union or labor action,
right.
Was expanding women's role in society.
Yeah, women were taking over administrative positions. Women were taking leadership positions, or studying engineering, or studying business at the city at Kabul's university. They held government jobs. There were 7 female members of parliament in the 1980s and such. So things started getting rather difficult for this revolutionary reformist government, given the lopsided aid from the CIA, the ISI, the Mujahideen.
The ISI is the Pakistani intelligence.
Right, the ISI, Pakistani. The government repeatedly made requests to Moscow for military assistance. Now, the Russians were already giving, the Soviets were already giving assistance in terms of agriculture, health services, and mining. They were very hesitant to commit militarily, because that really was an escalation of commitment. And they knew from history that Afghanistan was a pretty pretty dicey situation to get into. But they went in, finally. And when they went in, it was like throwing red meat, because the CIA then was able to recruit Islamic right-wing Mujahideen from about 40 different nations, including some from Pakistan itself, from Saudi Arabia, from Iraq, from Syria, wherever else. They went in there to now wage a holy war against the godless communists who were in. And so you had this long, ugly war, which ended with the Soviets departing and the PDP government left on its own. The government actually lasted another 3 years, to 1992, about a year, actually lasted a year longer than the Soviet Union itself, which collapsed, pretty much went out. So, poppy growing took over again, it flourished.
So it had gone down.
It had gone down under the not all that much, because the Progressive Democratic government had not made all that many inroads into some of the regions. So what happened was the Mujahideen warlords came in, and they slaughtered and murdered and raped, and they tortured the head of the government and killed him, being the nice guys they are. And they ruled the country some number of years. But before you know it, by the mid 1990s, I think it was, the Taliban took over. The Taliban were a especially extreme fundamentalist sect of young people, heavily funded and advised by the ISI of Pakistan and by the CIA.
And the ISI, we should say, really essentially helped the CIA created the ISI and worked very closely with
it. Right. That's right. And this is one of the best kept secrets in the world. the media, there are these memory holes where they just go out, you know, like that Saddam Hussein was supported by the CIA and all. You would never hear it. You would just never hear it. And you never hear that the CIA supported the Taliban and, in effect, helped create it. And once the Taliban came in, they did, if there's anything positive that could be said about these maniacs, is they did put a stop to much of the looting and raping and random killings that the Mujahideen had practiced on a regular basis. So so they were in power. And I would also like to point out how well Washington got along with the Taliban. As recently as 1999, let's see, that's Clinton, isn't it? Yeah. Under the Clinton administration, the U.S. government paid the entire annual salary of every single Taliban government official. By the way, in that international call that brought in all these people, all these Islamic extremists, one particular individual was a man named Osama bin Laden, who came in from Saudi Arabia. He with a bunch of other rich friends of his who helped finance things too. And so he, last seen, was in Afghanistan. So the CIA really, it was a Frankenstein monster. They created this monster. They left the wreckage that's there. It's the same wreckage that they left in Guatemala and in Haiti and in many parts of Africa and parts of Latin America and Asia. It is to prevent the people from any kind of democratic reforms, any kind of land reforms, any kind of self-development, self-education and such. And it gets down to a fundamental issue, is how the world, how's a nation, how a society is going to be organized. Is the land, the labor, the resources, the human intelligence of the society and the capital of the society, is it going to be used for the collective development and betterment of all the people generally, or is it going to be used as the special province of the favored few on the top? And the CIA and U.S. foreign policy has consistently, in each of these countries, attacked anybody who took that first course for a broad collectivist and democratic development. And so what you end up with is, if we can't rule, we'll ruin it, that's all. And they've ruined it. And they've brought ruin, as they've done in Iraq, for instance, which wasn't very democratic, but at least it was self-defining, self-developing. And, you know, there was education going on, all that. And then when Saddam Hussein proved himself to be a nationalist and was not a client state comprador leader at, jumping when the White House told him to jump, that's when they went after him. So any government that commits economic nationalism, any government that tries to make democratic reforms that help those who most need help, help them to develop themselves and become viable contributors to their society for a collective social betterment, any government that pursues those goals are to be targeted. And that's the story of Afghanistan. And that's what is still going on in Afghanistan. There's also the fact that that the U.S. very much wanted a military presence in Central Asia. And they got into Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and a few other places, and they built these rather impressive bases, and they built an enormous base in Kosovo also. And they could move in now. Now that the Soviet Union had slipped into history, there was nothing really to stop them here. And Afghanistan was a good jumping-off point for that. Afghanistan would also be good for the pipeline that was going to take out the immensely rich oil and natural gas reserves of Central Asia. Rather than depending on a Russian pipeline, which they didn't want to do, rather than going via China and out into the Pacific, they decided they could get a better deal by building their own pipeline through Afghanistan. As it turns out, ironically, I don't think a pipeline through Afghanistan is going to be very safe. The situation today is really, from the White House's point of view, from the imperialist's point of view, the situation is not at all a very promising one. The NATO troops there are not really really doing all that much, you know.
And Obama seems lost on this one.
Yeah. He's making noises. He's got to show that he's tough and he's going to be an interventionist and he's going to be ready to kill people, like Clinton had to show and like they all have to show that we can kill people. And that means we're tough and that means you're secure now because we're murdering. We can really go out there and whack them and take them out. He even used that phrase. Well, if there are these bases in Pakistan, we'll go take them out, you know. I remember seeing our friend Tariq Ali a couple of days after Obama made that comment, and he's a Pakistani, you know. He was quite upset. I mean, he's absolutely no friend to the current government, but still, I mean, to hear this guy who's supposed to be such a progressive and for change and all that, just talking like he's got to be an American gangster and vis-a-vis the rest of the world. Well, it's a successful policy in the sense that they destroyed a left revolutionary reformist government and dragged the people down to desolation and desperation again, and they established a very imposing military presence in Central Asia, an area they had never been in before, and that's what that's about it. And they've got their hands on all these resources in adjacent countries. If they were smart, they would just negotiate a settlement and a withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Well, that doesn't look like it's going to happen, Michael. We're out of time, but I want to tell people the timing of the article is great. I read it for a second time just before we went on the air, and people should check it out. I believe it's up on Common Dreams now. It's at ZNet. The article by Michael Parenti is called Afghanistan.
An Untold Story or Another Untold Story.
And his book forthcoming, God and His Demons, look for that as well.
It's not forthcoming yet. We're still trying to get a publisher.
All right. All right. Michael Parenti, thanks again, as always, for coming and being with us. You're listening to Flashpoints.
There's too many of you to cry. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer. Picket signs, sister. Don't punish me, sister. With brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister. So you can see, sister.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We now continue our series of community business with Catherine Austin Fitz. We take a look at what happened when the governor of Illinois cut off the Bank of America and sided with 300 workers who are about to lose their jobs. And with Catherine, we'll also revisit the bailout and examine the ongoing heist of the U.S. Treasury by the Bush administration and the big banks. And we're also going to take a look at the ongoing attempt to bail out the big three auto industry. Catherine, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, Dennis. What a week.
What a week we are having. It is interesting. I mean, the governor, now under arrest with his chief of staff, isn't the only official. The president-elect of the United States supported the workers, and a lot of people supported the workers, but the governor came right at the Bank of America, and he was sort of giving a support speech for the workers around the time he was arrested.
Right. Well, the day before, he said apparently at a worker sit-in, he said he was going to order it, their deposits pulled out of Bank of America, and the next day he and his chief of staff were arrested. So the U.S. attorney, Patrick Fitzgerald, produced an affidavit. It's quite long and detailed, so, you know, there's no way this investigation started when he said what he said about Bank of America. But I find after what we saw happen to Elliot Spitzer and what we've seen happen to other officials who really went for the jugular of the financial fraud, it's inconceivable to me that there's not a direct connection.
Of course, getting back to the Bank of America, which is getting billions of taxpayer money, I imagine these 300 workers who are about to lose their jobs are taxpayers. They were cut off by the Bank of America, so they're very frustrated.
Yeah, here you have a financial institution which is engaging in fraudulent inducement of your communities. They're using your state deposits to do it. They're selling securities to your pension funds that are draining off your retirement savings. So they're wiping out your retirement savings. They're wiping out your communities. And then they pull the plug on the very businesses you need to create any kind of income. You literally have institutions which are destroying the very wealth that gives them business and profits. I mean, it's really funny. Henry Ford used to say, when people would complain that he was paying his workers too much, he said, "I want them to be able to buy a Ford car." And we're in the unique situation where we've wiped out the American consumer, so the American consumer can't afford to, you know, do anything that will generate profits for Bank of America or the auto companies. And so the theory is we as taxpayers are supposed to bail them out, which is absurd, because if there are no consumers, what do we need them for?
Now let's ask and see if we can get some responses to some very practical questions about the bailout. Now I know you don't know every detail of this, but what can we say in terms of the bailout and how it's helping the hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who are facing foreclosure? Are they getting any help?
I would say, as a practical matter, no. What we've seen is a breakdown of the interbank lending and a breakdown of trust between financial institutions. And from what I can tell, most of the money seems to be going to cover losses from prior fraudulent activity and to shore up balance sheets and to do business that banks perceive to be profitable, like buying other banks. So you're seeing the money go into the wholesale system and not shift out to retail. Now, what the large banks would argue, if they wanted to effectively counter that, is to say two things. One is that the economy needs jobs and income, not more debt. And that's a fact, which is why pulling the plug on those workers is so frightening, because they're trying to manufacture things that have value in the marketplace. And if we cancel all things that generate income, then, you know, the system goes down completely. So one is that. The other is there's pressure on the banks to shore up their balance sheet. That's what they're trying to do with some of this money. But you don't see it trickling out in the economy because you have a complete breakdown of trust. And frankly, Dennis, you should have a complete breakdown of trust, because many of these institutions have proven themselves to be not trustworthy.
Now, shore up their balance sheets. How is that? Pardon me if I'm simplifying this a little bit, but isn't it sort of like taking the taxpayer money that they're getting from the Treasury Secretary and putting it into their own coffers?
Right.
That's what's happening. We,
right,
the taxpayers, are making sure the banks feel well.
Let me give you an example. If I'm a bank, one of the best ways I can make money is I borrow money, whether it's from the Treasury or the Fed in any of these bailouts, and then I lend it back. I buy Treasury securities in the open market, and I'm able to buy them and make more money on them than I'm paying to borrow money from the Treasury or Fed. So I make a profit. I call it a federal credit arbitrage. And I can make more money doing that riskless. Now, one of the things that's happening, which will add an interesting twist, is kind of the lemon in the martini, is this week, Dennis, we've seen yields on Treasury securities go to zero. Now, we've been seeing that around the world. About 2 months ago, when a one-year Swiss sovereign bond went to 0% yield. The Scandinavians have been coming down to zero. Germany's headed towards zero, and Treasury is at zero. So we're watching a rush of money into Treasury and government guarantees and out of anything that has risk.
And say a little bit more. I mean, the Treasury, people are paying more than face value. They used to pay a little bit less. They would get a bit of a yield, but it wouldn't be a risk. Now it's essentially sort of like paying for a safe deposit box for your money.
Well, in theory, it could get worse. If this continues for, say, a month or two, we could literally see money markets go to negative yield. So you get 0% on the Treasury securities, and then the money market has to charge fees for its administration. So you could, in theory, you could get a negative yield. And so that's quite an extraordinary situation, particularly because we're seeing all sorts of signs in the market that the perception of the credit of Treasuries is deteriorating. Literally, it's almost worse than putting money under your mattress.
All right, let's talk about printing money and the impact of printing so much money. I understand now they've hit a ceiling in the printing. That's why the government's going to issue its own, I guess, form of Treasury bonds to see if it can get some money coming out of the public, because they are in danger of printing too much. Talk about the dangers of printing money.
Well, let's say we have an economy and our only good is food. So we have vegetables. If you look at the aggregate monetary base, Dennis, as of early November, it was doubling every 6 weeks. So every 6 weeks, we double the amount of money that we're holding among all the different players in the economy. Well, there's still the same amount of vegetables. So double the amount of cash now has to go out and buy the same amount of vegetables. And so what you would anticipate is prices go up. Now, we haven't been seeing prices go up because as the economy slows down, we're watching less demand for all sorts of different goods and services. Essentially, what the Fed's position in central banks around the world is, so the multiplier that expands the money supply is shrinking, and so they're trying to offset that by just printing more money. And ultimately, you can't solve a cultural problem and a lawlessness problem with monetary policy. Now, if you're a central bank, you're going to try, but the reality is there's a deeper problem that has to be addressed. My quote to share up on my blog today was from a reporter in Bloomberg who was in Malaysia, and a taxi driver in Kuala Lumpur said to him, and I quote, "Why does Goldman Sachs run your government? What's wrong with America is that it's being run by investment bankers, mostly from the same bank. How can Americans stand for it? Is Barack Obama from Goldman Sachs too?" This is from a taxi driver in Kuala Lumpur.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Catherine Austin Fitz. Every Wednesday, we do community business with Catherine, who is our translator from Wall Street to Main Street. She is a former Wall Street banker, a former high-level official in the first Bush administration. She has thrown herself into community business and community banking. And Catherine, the other big bailout, and it, you know, it's hard to comprehend, and it really is hard for me to follow this and to keep it straight. But let's talk about the bailout of the big three auto workers. Now, the Bush administration and Congress seemed quite willing to throw hundreds of billions to save those banks that were too big to fail, the insurance companies who you can't let fail. But it does seem like these bailouts are smaller, and at least they have a direct relationship, unless I'm wrong, to keeping people in work. But yet it's harder to get the money. Why?
That's a very good question. And I don't know the answer, Dennis, because I think it's pure politics. I think the banks have the political clout, and the auto workers don't have the political clout that the banks have. Because my guess is behind this is a desire to really take out the UAW. You know, if not take them down a couple of pegs. Because I think this is a direct attack on labor. And I think the governor of Illinois situation really shows a little hint of sort of what's to come. Because if you're going to really dramatically decrease workers' pay in this country, you really have to take on and wipe out labor. So I think part of it is that if you look at the amount that the two auto companies are asking, because Ford really says it doesn't need anything right now, it's $15 billion. Let me put $15 billion in perspective. $15 billion is about 20 to 25% of what is expected to be paid as bonuses on Wall Street by the banks who've been bailed out.
I was infuriated to think that the Bush administration opposed using the $700 billion-plus that the Treasury Secretary now essentially controls, and this has to be other money. Why?
You know, I think what you're watching is economic warfare. And if you take down the auto companies and you take them out, you know, I think the guys who want to take them out are on the other side. If you don't bail out the auto companies, when it's all said and done, whatever's left will be controlled by the banks.
All right. You also have up on the blog the lawsuit or lawsuits against the Bank of America. You often talk about the government being involved in a wide-ranging, high-level sort of criminal conspiracy, and people sort of say, "Oh, that's hyperbole. That's not true. You know, this is a crunch. These banks may have made some mistakes, but you know, criminal activity, that's not real. That's overstating the case." I'm going to ask you to sort of look at this again.
What I've stated is, since the mid-90s, there was an intentional plan. It was run from the highest levels of the financial community and government to fraudulently induce America. We knew that globalization was coming, that there would be great deflation in labor, income and compensation. And if we were going to preserve a middle class, a strong middle class in America, we needed to do a series of things, including pay down our debt. The last thing we needed was to ask American households to take on more debt. And so a decision was made to do something else, which was basically to bubble the economy and, through the bubbling, Dennis, shift what I estimate to be about $10 trillion out of the American economy between 1996 and 2002. $4 trillion went missing from the federal government. That's illegal. It's unconstitutional for $4 trillion to go missing unaccounted for. That had to have left on the train tracks of the big New York banks, because the New York Fed is the depository for the U.S. government. At the same time, we saw the telecom pump and dump. We saw the internet stock pump and dump, and a whole lot of money legally shift out to the emerging markets. So we literally, a policy was instituted in the mid-90s called the strong dollar policy. And a series of different parts of that policy came together and in aggregate made it possible to shift this huge amount of capital out of the country. I've told this story in 1997 when I met with the head of the CalPERS pension fund, which is the largest pension fund in the country, and certainly in California. It's the 800-pound gorilla. And the president of CalPERS, when I presented my plan for revitalizing American community, said, "You don't understand. It's too late. They've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall." And that's when the fall of fiscal 1998 began. That's when we saw $4 trillion disappear from the U.S. government. So there's a reengineering. That's why I call it a financial coup d'etat. There is a reengineering at the top of the financial system through G8 and the treasuries and central banks to literally change on a planetary basis how assets are governed. And part of that is hugely centralizing political and financial control. So we're watching households and communities being asset stripped and the money shifted into large corporations and banks and ultimately to private investors. And one of the big questions questions for 2009 is, what's the end game? Because we're coming into the end game, and one of the things that can keep happening is we can keep doing what I call slow burning the economy, and we can keep the dollar high with violence and force, but it's going to take progressively more violence and force and more centralized control to do it. But the other thing we can do is we can have a big bang devaluation of the dollar, and that will help wipe out the debt. The problem is that will leave America really in a, most Americans in, you know, will experience, whether quickly or slowly, what happened to people in Argentina or Russia in the 90s. So we've seen, it's what Naomi Klein calls the shock doctrine. We've seen other countries who've lived through the shock doctrine, and the question is 2009 our turn?
Now, before we let you go, I want to get a characterization. Going back to the Bank of America, how would you characterize the actions, say, they're taking against the workers in Chicago and the way they're behaving in the context of the bailout? How would you characterize that behavior?
Norm Finkelstein has a great expression that he used as a title on a book. He said it's beyond chutzpah. I would characterize Bank of America's behavior in general and the bank's behavior as beyond chutzpah.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. If you want to communicate with Catherine Austin Fitz, argue with her about her ideas, you can check her out at solari.com/blog. Thanks, Catherine. We'll talk to you next week.
Good night, Dennis.
Tell me why the grass was greener years ago. I swear it used to grow here, but no more here. Tell me why on this hill all the birds they used to come to fly here, come to die here. And tell me why I need to know. Sometimes I wish I didn't have to know. Oh, you show me. What you say, should have stuck around for another day or two. Don't give up on me, I won't give up on you. Just believe in me like I believe in you. All the kids that used to come to run here, load their guns here. And tell me why it's okay to kill in the name of the gods we pray. Tell me who said it's okay to die in the name of the lies we say. Tell me why there's child soldiers. Tell me why they close the borders. Tell me how to fight disease. And tell me now, won't you please? The only thing I want to do is to be in the arms of someone who believes in me like I believe in you. And I say, hey.
Now we have this special and troubling report on what's going on with the savaging actions of the Jewish settlers in Hebron. Listen.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We return to the unraveling situation inside the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. Last Thursday, as we reported, hundreds of Israeli Zionist settlers attacked Palestinian residents of the city, setting fire to cars and homes and wounding dozens of people, nine of whom were shot by the settlers, who historically have been armed and backed by the Israeli military and police. In addition to these rampages in Hebron, which lasted throughout the weekend, other cities and villages across the occupied West Bank suffered similar attacks by settler groups near illegal settlement colonies and outposts. Palestinians have reported that settlers blocked roads, vandalized cars, and threw stones at Palestinians. These latest pogroms against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank by extremist Zionist settlers were sparked by an Israeli High Court decision in mid-November that ruled that 250 Israeli settlers must be evicted from a Palestinian home in Hebron. Settlers apparently had forged ownership documents of the house that they had stolen from the Al-Rajabi family. As settler attacks expanded in the West Bank, settler-affiliated groups inside Israel are preparing to march through predominantly Palestinian towns in the north of the country. A far-right group known as the Jewish National Front, an extreme Zionist organization associated with settler groups in Hebron, will march through the town of Umm al-Fahim during a demonstration of, quote, Jewish pride and solidarity with the extremist settlers in the occupied West Bank. The JNF's main platform is the expulsion of all Palestinians from what it calls, quote, Greater Israel, which includes the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, in the occupied Gaza Strip, a Palestinian man, 21-year-old Raed Youssef, was killed during a tank shelling by the Israeli military east of Gaza City on Saturday evening. Palestinian resistance factions responding to Israel's barrage of attacks over the last 3 weeks in particular, in which over a dozen Palestinians, including several children, have been killed, have been firing crude homemade rockets across the border aimed at Israeli military installations. No injuries have been reported. Last night, the deputy chief of the Palestinian Energy Authority announced that the Gaza Strip power plant ran out of fuel and ceased working completely on Sunday afternoon, plunging half of the strip into darkness. Israel has closed the Gaza crossings for 32 consecutive days and only selectively have allowed deliveries of humanitarian supplies to enter during 5 days in November and December. International leaders and the Palestinian people are decrying this complete hermetical sealing of Gaza's border crossings as illegal collective punishment. Overall, this is the 19th month of the economic and fuel blockade against Gaza by Israel after Palestinians voted for regime change, electing Hamas as their governing party and refusing to allow the Fatah party in Gaza to supplant their democratic choice. Joining us to talk about the current situation inside the occupied West Bank city of Hebron in particular is Hisham Sharabati. Sharabati is with the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, based in Hebron. He joins us now from his home. Hisham, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Thank you very much for giving this opportunity to reveal part of the truth about the difficulties and about the problems that the Palestinians who live in Hebron face on daily basis.
Well, we want to get into that. And I want you to take us back to what happened on Thursday at the beginning of this latest siege, this pogrom against Palestinians by settlers in Hebron. And you know, even Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who is no peacemaker or a supporter of Palestinian human rights in any sense, is calling what the settlers are doing in Hebron, quote, a pogrom against innocent Palestinians. But first, Hisham, if you could talk about the city of Hebron itself. The last 14 years in particular have been severely violent in terms of Jewish settlers, some of them actually coming from Brooklyn, New York, taking over Palestinian homes and attacking people on a regular basis. And of course, we also see graffiti on the walls of Palestinian homes in Hebron with the words, you know, Arabs to the gas chambers. And I've seen rape all Arab women written in Hebrew. Talk about the history here, just to give our listeners some background context.
Okay, we had the settlers actually arrived in Hebron short after the Six-Day War, 1967, trying to start the first settlement in the occupied territories after that war. The first group of settlers actually arrived in Hebron as a group of tourists in the only hotel in Hebron that time, and then they declared that they will never leave Hebron in any condition. After that, they had a deal with the Israeli authorities, the military authorities in the West Bank, and they agreed to move into two different military bases. First, one in Hebron, the military leadership of the, you know, the military headquarters in town. Then they agreed to move to another military camp in the east of town that later became the first settlement in the occupied territories post-67, which was named later Kiryat Arba. Anyway, then we had the settlers arrived in Hebron in late 70s after the Likud came to power after the public elections that time for the first time in the history of Israel, when Menachem Begin was the first prime minister of Israel from the Likud. All the time, you know, with these settlers that we have received in Hebron, those are very extreme people. In their mentality, their belief that the Palestinians are occupiers in the city of Hebron, and that one day they need to get rid of them. It's very clear. One of the women of the settlers, for example, who lives in the middle of town in the area called Tel Romeda, she was interviewed in She was interviewed on video saying that every day she wakes up in the morning, she looks to the opposite side of the where she lives, which is the other side is the Palestinian neighborhood, and she says, I know what is supposed to be done, and I know that one day I will be there. And so this is very short. The other example, maybe of settlers who live in Hebron, is Baruch Marzel, and Marzel, it's believed, I think he is born for American parents, if not himself was born in the United States. And Marzel was in a documentary done by Channel 4 British TV. He was interviewed in his room where it shows he had a sticker that says, I've already killed an Arab and you, which is a direct, you know, incitement to kill. Anyway, those people are not violent on words. Those people are violent in their practices against Palestinians. If you go to the areas close to where settlers live, you will see most of the Palestinian homes are empty. No people live there anymore. While the others, the few others who are remaining living there, they have metal screens on their windows to protect their glass from the stones thrown at them by the Israeli settlers. The people who still live there, they have daily suffering. They are daily harassed by settlers. Lots of them have done hundreds maybe of complaints to the Israeli police, and that did not contribute in changing their life to better in any case, while many of these people, as I said, has already left because of the closed eye by the Israeli security, the Israeli police, the Israeli army on the practices of the Israeli settlers in the city of Hebron.
That's the voice of Hisham Sharabati. He's with the Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq, and he's based in Hebron. Hisham, bring us up to date now with the recent siege against Palestinians in Hebron that was sparked last week. The Al-Rajabi home is one of hundreds of Palestinian homes you were just describing that have been taken over in the last 41 years. It was deemed an illegal takeover by the Israeli High Court a few weeks ago, and they focused on this one house. Why just this one house, and why did it take the Israeli military to evict the 250 settlers 3 weeks after the decision?
First of all, let's talk about, there is an importance, a strategic importance to the house itself. The house is on, it's like halfway between the Ibrahimi Mosque, Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron, and the settlement of Kiryat Arba. And close to that house, settlers use the route to go to worship in the cave or the mosque in Hebron. And so for them, it is an important place that will, you know, can be a future or part of a future project of having a continuity between the settlers' enclaves in the city of Hebron and the settlement of Kiryat Arba itself. As I said, it's on the route in the area that the settlers themselves call it the Worshippers' Road. So that is about the direct, let's say, direct importance of that house for the settlers. But in my view, there is another political meaning for it. You know, and the political meaning is that, you know, we had opposition for the right-wing movement inside Israel that says the settlement project is untouchable. You know, when we talk about future building, future Palestinian independent state or ending the occupation, in any way that should include the evacuation of the settlers and evacuating the settlements. And then for the settlers and for their supporters inside Israel, you know, this project is the important project. It's the project of the right wing in, of Israel, of the project, you know, for the whole, you know, to keep the whole, what they call the Holy Land of Israel, Eretz Israel Hashlema. So they want to maintain this project as much as they can. Maybe what shows, what supports this idea more, when we hear about 48 Israeli Knesset members, you know, MPs, have signed a petition calling the Israeli Defense Minister, who is in charge in the occupied territories, calling him not to evacuate the settlers out of that house, although it's the decision of evacuating them has came from the highest legal body inside Israel, which is the Israeli Supreme Court.
So talk about what happened on Thursday. The Supreme Court earlier in November ruled that this house should be evacuated. There are 250 Israeli settlers living there illegally. All the settlers that are in Hebron are there illegally, of course, as you mentioned. What happened on Thursday? Bring us up to date.
What happened on, first, as you said, the decision regarding evacuating the settlers has been taken by the court at the 16th of November. And the decision gave the settlers an opportunity to leave the house within 3 days. And they have refused to do so. And then the government, you know, the occupation government should have evacuated them after that. But because, you know, the Israeli government were going, let's say, in soft policy regarding the settlers, regarding implementing the Supreme Court decision, settlers had the chance to call for all their supporters and all their friends to come to Hebron and try to put obstacles on the implementation of the decision of the High Court. And since the decision was taken by the court, the area, the surroundings of that house, has had lots of attacks by Israeli settlers that included stoning Palestinian homes, attacking people in the streets, sometimes throwing firecrackers into Palestinian inside the clothes of Palestinian women who wear the traditional Palestinian clothing, beating worshippers going in and out of the closed mosque that is only 8 meters from the house that the settlers used to keep, going into the settlement and writing, painting the Star of David and, you know, pouring paint on the graves, and so on. Last Thursday, the Israeli police has started the evacuation of the house at nearly 2:30. The settlers were surprised of the attack of the police on them. And then they started attacking Palestinian homes, it seems, trying to attack the attention of the Israeli security to go away from that house. And then, so what happened, then a campaign of rampaging, a pogrom started against Palestinian families living close to that house. And that including setting fires on homes, depriving medical assistance to come, depriving fire brigades to come, and beating up individuals, and worse than that, using live ammunition against Palestinian residents who live very close to where to the Rajabi house. Of course, the results of that were 7 casualties who were wounded with live ammunition by Israeli settlers. While we can talk about maybe tens of people who were hurt in you know, lighter conditions, such as hit by a rock, or even sometimes children horrified, and so on. The Israeli police and the Israeli army, even after evacuating the house, after, you know, ending the operation of evacuating the house of the settlers, they did not interfere, you know, to stop the attacks of the settlers in a long time. And the Palestinians found themselves in a situation where they are very helpless. I know about cases when people get wounded inside their homes and they could not get any assist, any help, you know, by any side, and they were bleeding inside their homes or receiving support by their family members for more than an hour till they had an opportunity to leave to get medical help in the Palestinian hospitals, while in other cases the children who were wounded were carried away by their families for long distances till they got a chance to go and get medical treatment. The worst situation maybe was when people got their homes burned and they could not get the fire brigades, and they could not get even help from their neighbors to fight the fire, and they were having a situation where they are forced to fight a fire inside their own homes, you know, fighting the fire and moving from one room to another, trying to, you know, keep the children safe, trying to keep the rest of the house, you know, safe without being burned. While on the other hand, we see Israeli settlers on the rooftops of their homes, destroying the water tanks that may the water that could be used on fighting the fire and so on. To be honest, that was a very difficult situation in the city of Hebron. It was a very horrible situation, and that was a big reflection of the idea of keeping these settlements in the occupied territories. When Israel talks about a future independent state by having these settlers inside, that gives an idea that reflects, you know, the future of that state, how it's going to be.
Hisham Sharabati is with us talking about the current situation inside the occupied West Bank city of Hebron. And I just wanted to leave our listeners with this quote from the report in Ma'an News Agency from yesterday entitled Witnesses, Israeli Police, Soldiers, quote, deeply involved in settler attacks following Hebron House evacuation. And on Sunday, the New York Times posted on its front page, you know, a quarter page photo of an Israeli soldier dragging an Israeli settler out of the Rajabi family home. And Ma'an states, quote, the Israeli state, meanwhile, secured the publicity it sought, despite the riots. A photo of an Israeli officer dragging a shrieking settler from the house appeared, accompanying the New York Times staff-written account of the evacuation. The drama communicated to the world is that of the Israeli state boldly confronting its extremists. Only a sentence is devoted to the pogrom that was directly caused by the eviction. Hisham Sharabati, we will continue to keep on this story as it develops, of course, as we do every day here on Flashpoints. Thank you for all of your work and for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Well, you roll on roads over fresh green grass, for your lorry loads pumping petrol gas. You make them long and you make them tough, but they just go on and on, and it seems that you can't get off. Oh, I know we've come a long way, we're changing day to day, but tell me, where do the children play?
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight. Our interim technical director is Eric Klein, and our production assistants are Emily Howard and Evelina Molina. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Amanda Bellerby is our environmental producer and also produces the weekly Best of Flashpoints. To comment on today's program or to subscribe to our Fight Back email list, please contact us at flashpoints@kpfa.org. You can look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archived shows. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening. Music Breaks, Marvin Gaye, What's Going On, Michael Franti and Spearhead, Hey World, and Yusuf Islam, Where Do the Children Play? I'm Amanda Bellerby for Flashpoints.